So the House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleavorne.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Trying to decide between dark green, light green, and green sparkles for tomorrow.
Representative Mueller.
I will not be wearing any green sparkles.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston. Representative Poston. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang, excused. Representative Poston. That concludes roll call with 16 present.
Well, quorum has been established. This hearing is being conducted remotely on an electronic platform pursuant to Minnesota House Rule 10.01, Emergency House Operations in response to the COVID-19 infectious disease pandemic requiring public health exercise of social distancing. The public can view House Rule 10.01 on the Minnesota House website. The public can also visit the committee page on the website for instructions on how to access this hearing via streaming video, as well as instructions for participating in public testimony. Members, we have three bills today. You should have plenty of time then to dive into them. So I'm looking forward to the conversation. First order of business is to have our minutes adopted from March 12th, last Friday. I'm wondering if our vice chair can so move. Or anyone can move the minutes.
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes to be adopted as written.
Thank you. Representative Cleavorne moves adoption of the March 12th minutes. Representative Johnson, a voice vote is okay here?
That is fine.
Very well. Thank you. Discussion? If not, all in favor of adopting the March 12th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes of March 12th are adopted. The first bill up, members, is House File 861, Representative Hollins. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move that House File 861 be considered for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Sorry.
I think your motion is to refer to Ways and Means, and then we'll be laying.
Is it? Yeah. Oh, my bad. Ways and Means.
All right. So Representative Hollins moves House File 861 to the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Hollins, your bill is now before us.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. House File 861 is a bill requesting $4 million in annual investment for emergency funds and direct client assistance to support the needs of domestic and sexual violence victims and the victims of other crimes. The current funds are woefully inadequate to address basic needs of crime victims. We're asking for $4 million to be able to provide that direct money to survivors to meet their basic needs, things like rent and food. When COVID-19 hit in April, up until the end of 2020, Violence Free Minnesota gave out $500,000 in direct client assistance to survivors to cover things like their most basic needs. I mentioned rent and food, but also transportation, you know, housing assistance, et cetera. And even with that $500,000, they were not able to meet the need of the folks who were asking for it. So the need is great, and we anticipate that it's going to continue to be great, and that, in fact, it might grow, especially as we start to come out of this pandemic. We would like to allow survivors to access the emergency funds through direct client assistance grants from the grant-making unit of the Office of Justice Programs. And the coalition has met with OJP and decided to keep the bill language general for the details and mechanisms of distributions to be worked out on the back end. I have a couple of testifiers here to speak more to the language of the bill and the general need. Would you like me to introduce them, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please, Representative Rollins. Oh, not sure you heard me. I have Ms. Artika Roller and Katie Kramer. And so why don't we call forward Ms. Artika Roller, Executive Director of Violence Free Minnesota. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony, please.
Chair Mariani and members of the committee, my name is Artika Roller. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, MNCASA. And I'm here with Katie Kramer, the Policy Director with Violence Free Minnesota.
Welcome.
And I would like to share my screen.
Please do. Looks good.
There we go. All right. We are here to testify in support of House File 861, a bill that provides funding for victims and survivors of crime to mitigate the impacts of crime and harm those individuals experience. House File 861 is supported by each of the five state coalitions working to end violence and abuse, Violence Free Minnesota, MNCASA, as well as the Minnesota Alliance on Crime, Mending the Sacred Hoop, and the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Center. This bill provides funding to directly address the financial needs of crime victims. Crimes and violence crimes in particular have significant financial impact on victims and survivors. The needs are high. There are limited assistance available, and particularly in small and rural communities, the funds are very limited. The type of needs, and I will move on. The type of needs that crime victims in this bill would cover include repairing damages that happens during violence, things that are broken, like providing new locks, fixes to damages with cars, and much, much more. There's one example of Hope Center in Wright County that used the money to repair brakes that an abuser had damaged so the survivor could commute to work and school. Providing additional security measures to enhance safety for crime victims. Violence Free has provided funds for money and food. And assisting with medical and healthcare expenses. Medical and therapy co-pays, medical and therapy costs that are not covered by insurance. We also assist with financial needs with housing costs. This is one of the biggest financial needs that we find. First month rent, damage deposits, moving expenses, shelter stays when there's no shelter in their area or there's no shelter space available. For victims of domestic violence, direct financial assistance can be made, make a big difference in a victim's deciding whether they need to stay or leave a violent situation. She has a safe place for her and her children. Will she be able to get her job to her job, provide for her children? Direct financial assistance helps with the mitigation of chaotic situations, provides safety, security, and stability for victims and survivors. Now I'll pass it on to Katie from Violence Free Minnesota, who will talk about what funds are currently available for victims and survivors. Thank you.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Kramer. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, members of the committee. I'm Katie Kramer, Policy Director for Violence-Free Minnesota. So what funds are currently available? Currently, the Office of Justice Programs provides $150,000 in emergency funds each year. These funds are restricted to the victims of general crimes, crimes other than domestic and sexual violence. The funds are limited because there's insufficient funding to meet victim survivor needs. It's inadequate to meet the needs of general crime victims and nowhere near what is needed if you add in domestic and sexual violence victim survivor needs. The $150,000 is expended each year for general crime victims only. So the needs of all domestic and sexual violence victims would far surpass the fund at its current level. Many of the programs funded by the Office of Justice Programs, or OJP, have budget line items for direct client assistance, but the money available is not sufficient and it takes away from other program needs. For example, Someplace Safe, a domestic and sexual violence program serving 9 counties in West Central Minnesota, used up their OJP budget line item in the first 4 months of their current 24-month grant period. They have not filled an open advocate position as they are using those salary savings to continue to meet victim needs through direct assistance. In fiscal year 2020, Someplace Safe spent approximately $180,000 to meet direct victim needs. In the beginning of the pandemic, the coalitions and our member programs received COVID dollars specifically to provide emergency assistance. Violence Free Minnesota distributed nearly $500,000 in 9 months, providing funds to 553 individuals and families for everything from security systems, car repairs, food, winter boots for children, housing costs, and we did not meet the need. And the average check was about $850. MnCASA distributed $25,000 in 2 months. Women's Rural Advocacy Programs, or RAP, a domestic and sexual violence program serving 4 counties in southwest Minnesota, states, quote, one of the recipients of a phone and phone card was able to safely plan with her advocate, flee when it was the safest for her and her child, and is now in safe housing. She is now utilizing the phone to search for long-term housing, connect with possible employers, and find daycare for her son. So again, these are one-time money specific to the pandemic, but these COVID funds highlight the great need that exists for crime victims. The need that COVID-19 funds are meeting are great, they're growing, and they'll continue after the COVID-19 pandemic. So a little more on the extent of the need. More than 68,000 domestic and sexual violence victims receive services from our advocacy programs each year. This does not count the additional 46,000 receiving services as victims of general crime and 9,500 receiving abused children services. So based on various national studies, it's estimated that 50% or fewer domestic and sexual violence victims connect with advocacy programs. Since these are funds that would go to both victims working with an advocacy program and also victim survivors could directly access these funds as well. So it's important to look at both of those numbers. So how the funding would work? The proposed bill language has statewide coalitions working with the Office of Justice Programs to develop the mechanisms for distribution of these emergency funds, which would be open to all victims, not just those connected with programs, and would provide grants to programs dedicated to victim survivor needs. So funding will flow both through the 176 crime victim advocacy programs currently funded by OJP to every county in the state, and also be available to victim survivors who are not connected to a program. OJP has a strong history of working with the coalitions and community-based organizations and have a proven track record of distributing funds fairly and effectively. So in conclusion, research shows that a victim's safety is enhanced by providing them financial support. For example, providing a victim of domestic violence with money to secure stable housing not only reduces rates of homelessness, it also reduces rates of future violence. This funding would allow for survivors of crime to remove barriers that prevent them from having immediate access to safety and allow them to meet the basic needs of themselves and their children. So we ask for your support for House File 861 to support the needs of domestic and sexual violence victims and victims of other crimes. And I just wanted to note that in addition to Artika and I, we have Liz Richards, the Executive Director of Violence Free Minnesota, and Bobby Holtberg, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Alliance on Crime, on the line available to answer any member questions. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Kramer. And Representative Mueller, Representative Hollins, I'm looking at the wrong notes here. Representative Hollins, I'm struck by the testimony that I just heard for a number of reasons, but one that, frankly, I've never really embarrassingly, I think, thought about, which is when we talk about how crime costs society, we clearly have a strong feel for, you know, the emotional, psychological, spiritual, physical harm. And on top of that, it costs financially. I mean, if you're fixing somebody's brakes, you know, if you're fixing somebody's, you know, door lock or whatever, those are real, you know, you're paying a vendor somewhere to be able to do that. I'm really, just to Ms. Kramer and Director Kramer and Director Roller, I don't know the history of the crime, the General Crime Victims Fund. Can you just enlighten me a bit? How long has that been around and what has, I mean, you've laid out, I think, a pattern of, or not a pattern, but you've laid out some metrics in terms of it being used and, you know, how it's insufficient. Particularly for one would argue the unique costs, you know, related to sexual and domestic assault. But what can you tell us about the history of that that fund itself? How long has it been around? You know, has it changed, moved, evolved, et cetera?
Chair Mariani, we will actually ask Liz Richards to answer that question.
Oh, very well. Okay. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Richards. Please state your name for the record. And I think you heard the question.
Yes. Liz Richards, Director at Violence Free Minnesota. So, Chair Mariani and members, the Emergency Fund through the Office of Justice Programming, I don't know exactly when it started, but it's been around for many years. It has changed in its format quite a bit over that time. It used to be distributed to programs all across the state. Every program would get a little bit of money and to administer the funds. They then tried to get some consistency in administration of the funds because it wasn't just for people working with the individual program, but it was for any crime victim could contact the program to access emergency funds. So over the years, they then consolidated it down to 20-some programs around the state who were administering those dollars for anybody who contacted them. And then a few years back, and I want to say it's like 4 years, I might be slightly off in that number of years, they then consolidated it down to one program to administer the emergency fund statewide. And Cornerstone in Bloomington is the organization that distributes those funds. And one of the things that happened when it was consolidated down to one program is it was much easier to track the dollars and how they were going out. And what they found was that the dollars were draining out so quickly that they were going to run out of funding very quickly in that fund. So a decision was made by the Office of Justice Programming to limit the funds to general crime victims to access the fund in order to try and address the needs at least of one segment of crime victims. And so for the last few years, that fund has been restricted to general crime victims only. It isn't sufficient for that group of crime victims, but that's how the money has been directed. And I believe, and I don't have all the specifics, but it's been about $150,000. I believe they used some additional COVID monies over the last year to grow the fund a little bit in a one-time fashion. And the money comes both out of some of their general budget monies. They also take some money out of reparations that sometimes flows into this fund as well. So I don't have all the specifics about exactly what goes into that fund, but it's about $150,000 from the Office of Justice Programming. And at this point in time, it's restricted to the victims of general crime.
So that's helpful. Thank you, Ms. Richards. The follow-up to that is, the $4 million request, which is in the bill, so that's tied to, is it just the number that folks pulled out, or is it tied to some kind of, looking at, what the use and the hits, if you will, have been on the fund? What can you tell us of anything about the request itself, the amount of the request itself?
Chair Mariani and members, it's both and, I would say, in response to your question. So it's both looking at what do we see as the needs, so looking both at how much money was going out around COVID requests that were coming through. That's the place for the coalitions, because we have not historically been the funders of direct client needs in that way, but because of the money and the time period and trying to get money out quickly, we assumed that role as coalitions, and so we started to see the level of needs. So that's partly, and it's partly looking at what's a figure that we think. So that's partly why we looked at the extent of the need. I mean, how many victims are coming through our programs every year? And the numbers that we provided you from 2019, those come from the Office of Justice Programming and have been fairly consistent. So, so we know the volume of folks who are coming to our programs. We hear from our programs, Someplace Safe spending $180,000 last year out of their funds. So, sort of looking at those things and then also looking, what's a reasonable funding ask, also factoring in there. So it's a little bit about, making a guess, but basing it on some of those numbers of what we're seeing as need.
Well, clearly over time, I would imagine if we're successful with this, we should be pulling metrics, so to further inform legislators about whether we're meeting the need, underserving it, et cetera. It was pretty shocking to hear of a West Minnesota group that ran out of their 24-month, budgeted amount, if you will, within the first 4 months of their operations. That's pretty shocking. All right, we do have questions. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So I'm looking at the language of the bill, and I understand what you're trying to do. I get that, but the language is very broad, and this question is to the author of the bill. It just says crime victims, and it's not specified as in victims of violence or victims of sexual assault. It's completely broad, just a victim of crime, which could put us in the same problem that we've had with the other fund that gets expensed very quickly. So I'm wondering if, the language of the bill probably needs to change, but if you want to tell me what you're thinking about when you just say a crime victim. And the second question I have is, the eligibility requirements will be determined by the director of OJP in consultation. So I'm wondering if maybe that's more appropriate to be done in the legislature to determine some of these requirements. Again, because you've started so globally, you've said any victim of crime, and then you said the grant recipients will be determined by the department, by OJP. And then the third question I have is, you don't have a specific request, a requirement, of a report back to the legislature, and I'm wondering why you don't have that in the bill either. So those three questions to the author of the bill, please.
All right, three questions. Representative Hollins, and I trust you may also want to call in some of your witnesses to help answer.
Yes.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Those are all really good questions. I'm going to try my best to remember them as I go through looking at it. And I will also call on my testifiers to answer some of the more technical questions. So I think my understanding is that it was kept open for all for just crime victims in general, because we know that there are a wide berth of crimes that might be committed against somebody where they need assistance, and sometimes they don't all fit neatly into into domestic violence or sexual assault. You know, it can vary widely, and they might not be charged in that way, but still end up being the result of that crime, if that makes any sense. I would also say that my understanding of the Office of Justice, having it being administered by the Office of Justice, is particularly because they wanted to make sure that that we meet the needs of whatever victims and survivors are needing at that time. And we understand that that might vary. And so we wanted to have that flexibility instead of putting it into the legislation directly so that they're able to address things as they become clear. For example, I think prior to COVID-19, they might have not known that we needed, assistance with certain things. And now that assistance is, maybe seems obvious to us, but things change and we want to be able to adjust accordingly. And I would call on one of my testifiers to speak to this. I don't know if Liz would probably be the correct person to address it more completely.
I'll leave it to whoever, Ms. Richards.
Yeah, thank you. So a couple things. One is that the language that is currently in statute around funding is for crime victim services. So OJP administers the dollars for crime victim services. So that's the same language that's already in the bills in terms of the general funding. And they divide that into the categories of domestic violence, sexual violence, general crimes, and abused children. So those are the four categories that are included under crime victim services through the Office of Justice programming. So using the crime victim language is a mirror to what, it fits with the other funding schemes and how that money flows to them. As coalitions, we have all met and we do meet routinely and regularly with the Office of Justice programming have a clear understanding around what crime victim services mean and how funding stuff distributes. And I would say they have had a framework for doing this funding, albeit with limited dollars. So the current emergency funds have been set up and have very specific parameters about eligibility of who's eligible to apply and what kind of expenses are eligible to be paid. That flows with those dollars. OJP doesn't hand the dollars out. They grant the money right now to Cornerstone Program, which has to follow those guidelines. So that's one way the money comes out to victims. And then the other is through programs, that this money can also then be distributed to programs with a very specific earmark that it's for direct client assistance. And that also comes with programs having to meet standards and meet eligibility requirements. And our programs currently have to meet various state and federal requirements about who's eligible and eligible for what expenses. And so it's our assumption that those same frameworks and eligibility requirements would be applied to this money. It would just be a larger sum of money that could go much further. So that's with both of those things. I think in terms of report back to the legislature, I think that's not my bill, it's Representative Collins, but I can't imagine that any of us would have any objection, but actually welcome an opportunity to bring back information to the legislature.
Thank you. Representative Collins, to that last point, a report back. I'm thinking LJP provides reports generally anyway, but I do think that, with taking this step forward, that it would, I mean, I guess I would echo Representative O'Neill's, request that we get a report so that we can, in fact, and that was part of why I asked the question I asked in terms of, so what are the trends, what are the metrics here so that I know, that I'm doing all I can, to invest in help. So Representative Hollins, just very quickly in terms of your own willingness and
Yep, I knew I was going to forget one of them when I saw the list from Representative O'Neill. Thank you, Chair Mariani. I think reporting back would be fantastic. The more data that we can have on how these are spent and what the need is, I think the better prepared we can be in the next biennium to address this as well. So I'm definitely in favor of that.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate that. I would hope that the language could get a little bit more specific. I realize that once it gets to OJP, there are some parameters there, but I think it'd be helpful to have some of those laid out in the language itself here. I also am wondering a couple things. Is this an ongoing appropriation? It's not real clear in the language as I read it. And then also could this money be supplied for staff salaries and things like that, or is it, because it's so open and so vague in the language. I'm wondering, maybe nonpartisan fiscal staff could explain, would this be appropriate to pay for staff salaries of these different receiving agencies?
Let's get the intent first, and then we can turn over to our legal staff. Representative Hollins, on the intent.
The intent, my understanding is the intent is for direct funding for crime victims, not for payment of staff. And Liz, if you want to comment on that, you absolutely can.
No, I was just going to say that's it. Right. That, so Representative, the intent is that this money will go for direct victim survivor needs and would not go for programming costs.
And Ms. Richards, is it the hope and desire that this will be an ongoing appropriation on our part? Obviously, I get the answer. I get to be one of the people who answers that question as we put together our omnibus finance bill. But, it'd be good to know what the desires and the advice is relative to that.
So, Chair Mariani, yes, the need is not going to go away. This is not a need that has arisen just in this time, but these are longstanding needs. We anticipate them to be continuing in the future, and so looking for an ongoing appropriation would be the preference.
Thank you. Mr. Waltz, I take it the way the language is built right now that it's not – it's not an ongoing appropriation.
Mr. Chair, yes. This is Ben Johnson. I can address both of the questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
And Mr. Walls can correct me if I'm incorrect, but Mr. Chair and members, the appropriation is in both years of the biennium. Since the appropriation appears in the second year of the biennium, the assumption is that it is an ongoing appropriation unless it says otherwise. This bill does not say otherwise, so it is drafted to be an ongoing appropriation. As to Representative O'Neill's other question, the language here, page 1, line 8, says that the grants must go to victim survivors of crime. So the assumption here is that it would be going directly to those individuals, those survivors. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative O'Neill?
Thank you. I would just ask again that a little bit more information would be in the bill as far as what type of crime victims. And if you want to put in those four categories or something, I think that would be helpful. I think it's a very small bill. It's just one paragraph, but I think a little bit more information would be helpful. Thank you.
There may be some wisdom in that, Representative Hollins. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members. And I just have a couple of questions. I echo all the questions that Representative O'Neill asked, and thinking how important it is for us to support these victims. And at the same time, I was looking at the governor's budget and saw that it has a request for an additional $10 million for crime victim survivor grants. So is this an additional appropriation? Is this in tandem with the governor's budget? How does this all work?
Representative Hollins or any of the advocates in terms of relationship with the governor's budget. Obviously, we're going to be making that decision as a committee. I doubt we're going to be able to fund everything that is going to be before us. So we're going to be making and voting on all sorts of ways to construct this. But obviously, you know, to the degree that, you know, there's a, you know, a sort of a meeting of needs and requests in the executive branch and individual legislators, that's one way to answer that. But just curious, Representative Hollins and or the advocates, in terms of the development of this proposal and relationship with the governor's budget. Is there one? Is there not? Just anything you can share with us.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and thank you, Representative Mueller. I think that's a really fair question. From my perspective, I can only say as much as I know, but as much as I know is that this was brought forward and has been worked on since long before the governor made his budget proposal. So I think that it coincides with the governor's budget proposal and that he's also seeing a need there, but not that it is necessarily in addition to what the governor has proposed. And I would turn to any of my testifiers to back me up or contradict me as necessary.
Feel free to jump in, whoever.
So Chair Mariani, members of the committee, a couple of things here. One is that you would note that the language in the governor's budget is much more broad and comprehensive. It is talking about victim resources, and I believe the phrase is, and to stop cycles of violence. So our understanding is that, and this partly goes to Representative O'Neill's question, that the way that this is placed into the governor's budget is much broader and would encompass our programs receiving additional money and can also be used for some of the kind of community-based programming currently happening that is not currently being funded. And specifically, I would talk to some of the programming around restorative justice, the programming that works with domestic abuse, people who've used violence or domestic abuse transformation programming. So some of those things which are not currently funded any place would be included in the more comprehensive language as part of the governor's budget language.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair. So then my last question would be that we did hear a testimony just earlier that that OJP sometimes takes money from the Crime Victims Reparation Board because of the lack of funds. And so could an individual receive money from both of these programs? And how do we know which one they are eligible for? How will we know if they've gotten both funds? I just want to make sure there's full transparency in what's happening.
It might be a question for the department. I don't know if anyone's here to take a gander at that. But in the meantime, any other testifiers? Okay. I think it's a really good question, Representative Mueller, and we are going to be laying this bill over, and I think it's an appropriate question to engage the department in terms of its practices relative to your inquiry.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. Very well. Well, members, thank you for the good vetting, good discussion. Thank you, Representative Hollins, Ms. Roller, Ms. Kramer, and Ms. Richards for being with us, and Ms. Hoper, thank you all for being with us here today. Representative Hollins, the chair is going to lay over House File 861 for possible inclusion in the. Actually, I should give you a final word. I'm sorry. I apologize. Any final words of encouragement or wisdom or all that stuff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. I appreciate the conversation around this. I think these are all really important questions. I want to thank my testifiers for being here today. And I guess I would simply note the need for this money, for these grants to be given. I didn't even recognize the
We'll give Representative Hollins a second. She had texted me that, there you go. you got to clear that snow off of something in your backyard.
I'm sorry. I don't know what's going on with my internet. I'll just thank my testifiers and thank the committee for our robust discussion. And I would appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing us a good bill. With that, the chair lays over House File 861 for possible inclusion in the committee's omnibus bill. Members, next is House File 478, Representative Feist. Representative Feist, do you have a motion for us?
Yes, Chair Mariani. I do have an amendment. So I don't know, I forget if that comes before I requested
We got to bring the bill up first. So Representative Feist moves to refer House File 478 to the Ways and Means Committee. The bill now is before us, and Representative Feist, you do have an author's amendment. It's a DE amendment, so pretty obvious it's going to, you know, the intent is to have the bill before us the way the author intends to have it before us. So Representative Feist moves adoption of the DE4 amendment. Representative Johnson, you're okay with a voice vote on this?
Yes, I am.
Very well. Thank you, sir. All in favor of the DE4 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and House File 478 is amended with the DE4 amendment. Representative Feist, your bill is before us the way you wish it to be.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee. I'm happy to be back before the committee for a vote on the Veterans Restorative Justice Act. As a reminder, this bill creates statewide access to a specialized restorative sentencing structure for eligible veterans who have committed lower-level criminal offenses as a direct result of a service-related condition. This bill has the support of a broad coalition of stakeholders, including prosecutors, defense attorneys, veterans groups, as well as victims advocates such as Violence Free Minnesota. This bill makes us safer through impressive reduced recidivism by providing the support to veterans to confront their acts, seek the treatment that they need and deserve, and to rejoin the community of law-abiding citizens. Incredibly, this personalized approach to sentencing is projected to save $1.2 million. I would like to thank Representative O'Neill for her time and expertise as we discuss the amendments that I incorporated since our last hearing, and I believe make this a stronger bill. Since we've already heard testimony on the bill, I'd like to take the time to walk through those changes. First, we have added at Subdivision 2 a Rule 25 chemical use assessment. Second, we have added language in Subdivision 3 in several places to more center the victim in this bill where applicable and to ensure that the victim would have an opportunity to testify or submit a written statement as part of the court's consideration in dismissing charges at the end of the treatment program. Next, at Subdivision 2D, we explicitly stated that the court may extend veterans' term of probation for additional treatment, services, and education pursuant to 609.135 Subdivision 2. Next, we eliminated a paragraph that equated treatment with time served to ensure that treatment is not equated with punishment or an imposition on liberty. And lastly, we eliminated all predatory offenders from coverage under this bill. Individuals required to register under 243.166 will not be eligible for restorative sentencing under this bill. I ask the committee to stand with the prosecutors, public defenders, advocates for victims of domestic violence, and all of Minnesota's 9 congressionally chartered veterans service organizations by voting yes on this bill. Since we had testimony at our last hearing, including Ms. Kelsey Jazierski from the Domestic Abuse Project, I wanted to leave time this afternoon for discussion on this bill and to answer any questions. And with that, I'll just let the chair open discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. And thank you for working diligently to shape this bill. Looks like you work with Representative O'Neill in that regard, so thank you both. So, discussion, members. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So I appreciate the work that's been done. There are many outstanding concerns that I have. And actually, the outstanding concerns are the greatest concerns. Well, you know, I really do appreciate that this bill is more victim-centered. My concern still remains squarely on the backs of those that are impacted by the crime. And I do take just a little issue with the fact that it was characterized as a lower level crime. Again, we're starting with a severity level 7, which could include and does include domestic assault by strangulation as just one example. So these are intimate crimes. They are very violent crimes. And so another issue that was raised before I get into my list of concerns was something that was raised in the Senate hearing. They had an informational only hearing. And as I was listening to that, it really kind of drove home the separation of powers issue between the legislature and the judiciary. And my concern is at the very beginning of this process, the only factors that a judge needs to determine are the three factors. One, are they a veteran? Two, did they suffer some ill effects from their service? And did that ill effect have an effect on their criminality? Once those three factors are determined, then all the defendant has to do is request that they can start this process. And at that point, the judge is ordered to start the diversion process. It says shall or must. The judge must allow this process to continue. And so that is a big problem with the legislature ordering the courts to do something. The only thing that is even slightly close to that would be the mandatory minimums that we do from the legislature. So that's number one. There's I would say that there is an issue with separation of powers that's very apparent and was really, really discussed at great length on the Senate side. So on to the rest of it. So once the defendant is in front of the judge, and the judge, once it's requested and those three factors have been satisfied by clear and convincing evidence, then that the judge must order what comes after that. And so there are many things that could come after. It could be, obviously it's probation, but it's also could be different levels of treatment and so on, which of course we want. But at the very end of the process, and I do have to say that at this point, Representative Feist, I thank you very much that you actually allowed treatment time to continue. So the way it was written initially was that treatment could not continue farther past than what the sentence would have been, which is problematic because it takes some people a very long time to finish treatment. As you know, I used to work at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, and I could tell you story after story of folks that need significantly more time than the 1 year, which it typically is. They sometimes go as long as 18 months or more. But in any case, when the defendant comes back in front of the judge, then there are four factors by which that judge has to determine whether or not that this case will be completely dismissed and discharged. And then not only that, but then all of that goes into a non-public data status, because I know that there's a concern about collateral consequences. But let's go to a couple of the factors that are of concern to me. One is you only have to be in substantial compliance, not complete compliance, with probation at that moment in time that you're considered done with this diversion program. So in treatment court, whether it doesn't matter what type of treatment court, in order to graduate treatment court, you actually have to be in compliance at that moment of graduation. So if you akin this to this process, to say substantial compliance, one, some courts don't even know what that means because they don't talk in that kind of language. It's either compliant or not compliant. For those that may know what that means, it could be as little as 50% compliance at that moment in time. So that's a problem. And I know she and Representative Feist and I talked about changing it to just being in compliance with probation. I would absolutely need that change for sure. That is one of my must-haves to be able to be supportive of the bill. The second problem that's even bigger than that is participation in treatment. The bill right now just says that they have successfully participated in treatment. Now, I have no idea what that even means. I don't know even what that means, but what it should say is that they have completed treatment, that they have successfully completed treatment. So that would be another really important factor that needs to be changed before I could support the bill. And there's also the concern about this data. So once you've gotten into this point of, you know, if you've met all four factors and
the judge is about ready to discharge and dismiss, then it goes into a non-public data status. And it's very unclear, which is always bad in legislation, it's very unclear whether or not that data now goes on the prohibited person, so 624.713, if it now becomes part of the background check to purchase, to possess guns, and possibly to get a carry permit. So the language is unclear. I'm not sure. I mean, there's other members of this committee that know a lot more about that, but that is of great concern to me, that there's still the potential that this person who has been deemed at least there's a causal factor between their service and their criminality, that we immediately allow them to be a legal gun owner. I have concerns about that. And why do I say that? Because if you look in 624, it's very clear that if you have gone into drug and alcohol treatment, so as soon as you complete treatment, there's still a three-year window before you can get your gun rights restored. This completely bypasses this, and you go directly to gun ownership again. I don't know if that's wise. I think it's not. Also, if you have mental health treatment, so there is a considerable amount of time, and it could even be a lifetime ban on owning dangerous weapons. So there's that consideration. And finally, I have a concern. I believe that the courts would probably also have this concern that the funding needed to make this happen would pull money away from veterans' courts. So that is also a concern. So those are just a few of my concerns that are still outstanding. So mandatory minimums. So there's also a paragraph in there that is a permissible, so that the judge could permit this process to happen if you are subject to a mandatory minimum. But what it doesn't say is, does that mean now you're going above a severity level 7, so murder? There are some murders that are in that section. So are we now saying that someone that's committed murder could do a complete diversion program, and then as soon as they're done, that charge, all of the charging information, it's all dismissed as non-public data. So it's really unclear what the mandatory minimum allowance is doing. And so that really needs to be clarified, because I'm really uncomfortable with allowing that level of crime. And it's unclear which way it goes. So those are just a few of my outstanding concerns, and I believe my colleagues probably have a bit more.
Yeah, we do have some others as well, so we'll go to them. Representative Feist, I see you want to jump in, so let's do that. I do want to remind members that when we heard this bill, a couple of weeks ago, on the 4th of March, and this is prior to the amendments here, that the Minnesota County Attorney Association was supportive of this legislation, as were public defender, and as violence-free as well. But Representative Feist, comment, and then we still have questions from Representative Botney and Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be efficient. I guess I'll go in order. So we amended the language to take out all predatory offenders. And I do believe that severity level 7 does include certain, is severity level 7 crimes, but I do believe, as well as the prosecutors and victims advocates and veterans groups, that this is the appropriate place to draw the line. The separation of powers issues is a really interesting question. I feel that this is pretty analogous to a lot of scenarios where we do direct sentencing. As Representative O'Neill mentioned, mandatory minimums are a really good example. Another is when we do deferred prosecution for first-time drug offenses. It's also analogous to the expungement process. It's also analogous to situations where we set fines. For example, the legislature directs courts to set specific fines in racketeering, which is my law partner's expertise, so I know about that. So I think there are a lot of situations, like another, just one more example, when the legislature collaborates with the Minnesota Commission on Sentencing Guidelines, like that's another example of where we're setting parameters around the sentencing by the courts. So I feel like this falls on the right side of that line, but it's a good question to always have in mind. As far as a few of the issues that Representative O'Neill raised, I do believe and would be really interested in continuing my conversation with her that we have a path forward that addresses those concerns. Specifically, the language around which data remains public, the language around substantial compliance versus compliance, participation versus completion. All of those, I feel like we have a path forward with language that we can all be comfortable with. As far as the funding goes, I think that we can actually delete a paragraph that will address that issue. And then lastly, the mandatory minimum section, it actually got updated in the most recent DE amendment, and I do believe it's much more clear. So I would just mention that because I do think that the previous section around mandatory minimums, I agree, seemed very expansive, and that the new language sets more clear parameters around how that would function within this bill. So those are just some of the responses, but I would really welcome, you know, a continued conversation with Representative O'Neill, because I believe that all of these are areas where we can kind of find common ground and language that we're comfortable with and works for this bill and makes it the best possible bill. So thank you. And sorry, other people have questions. I'll stop there.
Of course, yeah. And Representative Feist, House File 478 has been heard in Judiciary, am I correct?
Correct.
All right, very well. Representative Otney, then Representative Johnson.
Oh, thank you, Chair Mariani, and Representative Feist, thank you for bringing this forward. Thank you for being open and taking the suggestions. I was just going to briefly make a comment that, you know, still have the concerns about how we address, you know, being in line with the federal guidelines on the positions to the permit to purchase, permit to carry, you know, prohibited persons from firearms, and making sure that there's a mechanism in place to deal with that. So what might be okay by state standards would not be compliant with the federal standards. So it sounds like you're making substantial work for that. And Representative O'Neill made that question very eloquently. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Otney. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Feist, I want to thank you for trying to make this bill a little better. It's a worthwhile cause, but I think there's still some major issues with this bill that need to be worked out. And they should not be worked out as they're making its way through the process with just one more stop before it goes to the floor. Now, I have a lot of concerns. I myself have no problem with people exercising their Second Amendment rights, but we do have some disqualifications both at the state level and also at the federal level. Minnesota law requires that a sheriff, I believe, has 7 days to get a permit to purchase turned around and back to the person. It's either 7 or 10 days. And as in the bill on 5.20 to 5.29, it talks about that issue where the conviction and the dismissal would be not public. And if a prosecutor or sheriff's office or something needs the information, they'd actually have to get a court order to get the information. Now, if we have 7 days to obtain get the information out for a permit to acquire either a firearm or a handgun or a military style assault weapon, there might not be time to get that information to find out what the situation was if the person is not eligible to have that. This is an issue that needs to be taken care of. Also, on the permits to carry, sometimes it takes much longer to get that information, even at that 30-day mark, to find out. And what's even more concerning, as I'm reading this latest DE amendment, on 5.26, it starts, the discharge and dismissal shall not be deemed a conviction for the purpose of disqualification, disabilities imposed by law upon conviction of a crime for any other purpose. So right in the bill, you have it. Person would have been disqualified under federal law for domestic assault and current law, which requires a 3-year wait for chemical abuse before getting their firearms rights back. Right in the bill, you say this does not apply, which is in conflict with federal law because of that, if it was a domestic assault situation. So I think this needs to be worked on and worked on carefully. And with that in there, just for the safety of public and the safety of those who have been victims of domestic abuse, I cannot support this bill.
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. A lot of the issues that you're raising are really good issues, and we found some language, Representative O'Neill and I, that I think would address them. And so I'm very sorry, people keep texting me and it pops up on my screen. Anyway, I do think that there are ways that we can address the concerns in terms of who has access to the data, specifically law enforcement access. With respect to, I guess I have two other points I'd like to make. I feel like this process is working as intended, Representative Johnson. Like, as we've gone from committee to committee, we've received feedback and we've incorporated that. So I feel like things are going well, and I've been really grateful for the feedback. I guess the last point I just want to make is that a stay of adjudication that already exists in our criminal law, and there are situations where we really do want to give people the opportunity to get those charges dismissed. And I believe that if we can incorporate language, if everyone is comfortable with language around who has access to the data, which data is public, how the prohibited person's rules interact with this law, I believe that we can find common ground that everyone feels comfortable and, you know, is in alignment with federal law and protects public safety. And ultimately, this bill really is about protecting public safety. We are giving an opportunity to people, veterans, to seek treatment, you know, to get the services they need to really confront the challenges in their life and become law-abiding citizens once more. And that is in the interest of victims, and it's the interest of public safety, and it's awesomely cost-effective. We're going to save money. And I just think, for those reasons, I think this is a great bill. So thank you.
Okay, very well. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, Representative Feist, I agree. We want to get that to that point. The problem I see is this is one more stop in Ways and Means, not the judiciary, not the public safety area, it's the finance area. This needs to be fixed and done proper before it gets to that point, because that's the last step before the floor for the general register. So I'd like to see this bill just laid over and continued work on it. We have time. It's one thing to do the right thing, but when we do it, we need to do it in the right way. Thank you.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist, for bringing this bill and for working so diligently on it for such a long while. I just wanted to speak in favor of this. I didn't get a chance to the last time we were in judiciary, but I have met people who have gone through this program or similar program, and it's literally life-changing. And the person I know did have a history of abuse and now has an ability to control that abuse. The person I know was able to turn his life around. And I think that when we look at the recidivism rates of our veterans and what we're facing, we know that what we're doing currently isn't working for them. Like, we have to do something different. And so while I absolutely respect the you know, critiques that are coming your way and the things that we're looking at to tweaking, I do think that this is a step in the right direction towards serving the people who have served us in our country and giving them a fair chance to make good of their lives. So I'm really excited about this bill, and I really thank you for carrying it.
Representative Feist, I guess you get the last word here.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And thank you, committee, for this really good conversation. I'm glad that we had the time for it. I would just like to thank Representative O'Neill again for all of her input and expertise. And I'm glad that she does serve on the Ways and Means Committee. So if we do get there, I assume we will get there at some point, we'll have an opportunity to make sure that everything really is in the best possible shape. So I can't put it better than Representative Hollins. Like, we are, you know, people who have served us, we are now offering them this opportunity to receive the treatment and the services that they need and to be full members of our community and to achieve their full potential. So thank you so much. I would encourage people to vote for this bill. Thank you.
Very well. Representative Feist renews her motion that House File 478, I have the right number. Representative Feist renews her motion that House File 478, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Johnson, nay. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn.
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Lucero, nay. Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes no.
Representative Mueller, no. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Representative Novotny, nay. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no, for now.
Representative O'Neill, nay. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
No.
Representative Poston, nay. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, nay.
Representative Raleigh, nay. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang, excused. That concludes roll call with 10 ayes and 7 nays.
Very well. With 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails. And House File 478, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Good luck to you, Representative Feist, in the next committee. All right, so our last bill for today is House File 401, Representative Hansen. And Representative Hansen, the chair moves to refer House File 401 to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Hansen, your bill is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Nice to be back in front of your committee again. It's kind of, haven't been here for a long time, and now twice in within a week, so glad to be back.
Stay away once you discover what wonderful people populate this committee. Welcome back.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 401 is resolving a conflict that occurred in the October special session last year, where one job description within a bargaining unit in state government received an 8.4% increase, and the other members of that bargaining unit did not. And so that other members of the bargaining unit, the reason I'm carrying this is we have conservation officers who are within the Environment and Natural Resources Finance budget. This has also been to the Commerce Committee and now to your committee because it affects a number of different agencies. And as it has been moving through the process, I am pleased that we've been gaining bipartisan support. Nearly every session we get some other co-authors. So this is the right thing to do in your packet. There is a signed letter by a number of the organizations affected, and it's just the right thing to do here to provide that equality in terms of the pay increase to all members of the bargaining unit. So I'd ask for your support.
Very well. Do you have a testifier, Representative Hanson? I have a Doug Henning.
Doug Henning, I think, had the letter. I'm not sure if he's going to testify in person or not.
Okay. I do see him here. Mr. Henning, if you wish to come forward and offer some words, so we'll gladly hear that. And ask you just to state your name for the record and provide us your brief testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Doug Henning. I am the president of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Agents Association. And I'm here today to support House File 401. I would like to start by thanking Representative Hanson for authoring House File 401 and the committee for allowing me this time here to testify in front of you. Your quick action in this session will demonstrate your critically needed support for pay parity for your state law enforcement officers. I am a 27-year veteran law enforcement officer. The last 15 of those have been as a special agent with the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I'm currently assigned to the homicide section at headquarters here in St. Paul. I conduct and assist with death investigations, primarily in the metro area, but also in greater Minnesota as well. In addition to my current assignment, I also assist with instruction of BCA's search warrant and crime scene investigation courses. The approximately 800 law enforcement officers that make up MLEA, including the state troopers, BCA agents, Department of Commerce agents, Department of Corrections, apprehension specialists, Department of Public Safety, alcohol and gambling agents, and DNR conservation officers have collectively bargained together with the state for almost 40 years. The action in the October 2020 special session to provide a market adjustment to the state troopers was certainly warranted. There is no question that the data shows state troopers are making less than their comparable peer groups. We have similar data, which clearly demonstrates this market adjustment should be extended to our groups as well. In fact, the data shows our group is 13.8 to 17% behind most of the state and up to 20% behind the larger metro departments such as St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Bloomington. Each and every officer and their family deserves the care and attention paid to right the current inequity in their pay and benefits. Law enforcement work is more difficult and stressful than ever before. As you can imagine, this is about recruitment and retention for all of our agencies. The pool of qualified candidates to fill law enforcement positions in Minnesota is not what it once was. For the BCA and other agencies, this is about attracting diverse and qualified candidates. Addressing this pay equity issue will assist in drawing candidates to our state agencies that are reflective of the communities we serve. This wage adjustment will assist state law enforcement agencies by keeping wages competitive. This effort will hopefully attract the best candidates to fill vacancies in future hiring as well. Here at the BCA, we're growing into different roles, such as human trafficking, the Fusion Center, statewide use of force investigations, financial crimes, predatory crimes, as well as others. Also, over the last year, all of your state law enforcement officers have been called to serve during periods of civil unrest. Together, the troopers, conservation officers, fugitive specialists, and special agents answered this call and assisted their partnering agencies during this time of crisis. In conclusion, I'd like to thank you for your time and attention today. Please support your state law enforcement officers and pass this bill to help ensure this inequity is addressed immediately. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you, Agent Henning. And members, there is a letter in our both posted and in your packets, your virtual packets, from the BCA Agent Association, Conservation Officers Association, Gambling Enforcement Agent Association, Commerce Fraud Agents, Fugitive Apprehension Agents and the MPPOA. So thank you for that. Representative Hansen, I also saw Assistant Commissioner Hodges here. And so at this point, I'll ask Assistant Commissioner Hodges to come forward, identify his name for the record, and testify. Although, hold on, Representative Hansen, I do see an amendment, and I'm wondering if maybe, I'm not sure if the commissioner was here to speak to the amendment, and so perhaps maybe we should take that up at this point, Representative Hansen.
Yeah, we can deal with the amendment. It's not my amendment, so.
Okay, all right. So who has the A2 amendment, and will that be offered?
Chair Mariani, Representative Johnson, I have an amendment. I wish to offer it.
Very well. Representative Johnson moves adoption of the A2 amendment. Representative Johnson, to your amendment.
Well, what this amendment does, it adds the supervisors and managerial licensed peace officers to this bill. What we have found out, and this was an issue before that 8.4% increase in the troopers, what's happening is right now the troopers are catching up to, and with just not a lot of overtime, surpassing the supervisor salaries. So what's happening, those officers that have 8, 10, 12 years experience, know what's going on, understand the issues, have a very level head, are not taking the test to move on to a higher rank because of they're going to get paid less. So what's happening, younger officers are doing that. And there's some good officers as well doing the going for the lieutenants and the higher supervisory positions. But I want the best qualified, not the ones that aren't going to take a pay cut. I want the best qualified. And what this amendment does, it gets it back to not where it needs to be, but with this 8.4% increase, talking about the troopers alone, a trooper with 3 years on doing one overtime shift a month will probably make more than a lieutenant. And that's getting to a point where it's getting so lopsided that we're not getting the best qualified people, I believe, going for those supervisory positions. And this is a way to try to compensate that to the point where it won't get farther out of whack than it already is. And with that, I hope that you will take this amendment and add it to this bill.
Very well. Representative Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would oppose the amendment. I believe in collective bargaining, and I think that, you know, the challenge we're in with the need for this bill is the legislature acting for a particular job description rather than within a bargaining unit. What I'm trying to do in House File 401 is equalize that throughout the bargaining unit. And, you know, with Representative Johnson's amendment, I understand what he is trying to do, but that would actually replicate the problem in the Middle Management Association, which is a separate bargaining unit. It's a bargaining unit that I actually used to be in at one time, and I understand progression because I was in MAPE and then went into middle management when I became a supervisor. So I understand progression. I understand those issues, but it's not right for the legislature to be starting to set pay for job descriptions, and that's led us to the challenge we're in. The reason this has moved through several committees so far is that it is there's financial costs in each of our agencies that the committees have been in for the employees that are covered in MLEA. And so by picking one particular job description in MMA, you're also setting the pattern there that would have a significant potential cost. And I'm sure that there are many people watching the committee. Our brothers and sisters in AFSCME and MAPE would also be very interested. So we need to fix the problem within the MLEA bargaining unit and not expand the scope. So I would ask for your no vote on the Johnson Amendment.
Representative Hollins.
Is my hand still up? It shouldn't be.
Okay.
Representative
Otney.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. First of all, I'd like to call a roll call on this amendment.
Roll call has been called. We will take a roll.
Thank you, Chair. To the author, we just heard in Judiciary the issue. I spoke briefly about we're losing good peace officers throughout the state. Representative Frazier testified or, you know, spoke to this in Judiciary just this morning that we want to keep the best and we want to keep the brightest. To do that, we need to make this financially advisable and rewarding for them. If we want these officers to be led by the best, then we're going to need to that enticement for the best officers to step up. Having been in this situation, I think it's fairly obvious. We are here right now. We can pass this amendment and we can solve this problem right now. If we want to stay with the theme about doing the best and getting the best supervision and getting the best people out there, making sure that the policies that are coming down are being followed, we need to have the best available. So I would speak in favor of this motion.
Well, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lavadney, thank you for sharing the discussion this morning. But I just want to be clear this morning. Your comments were a clear objection to collecting data that would create a system to prevent harm being done to community members that officers are sworn to protect. This argument you're making now, which is not one that I was speaking to, it's about finances and about appropriately paying public servants, which I don't disagree with, but I just want to be clear about the context of the conversation we were having this morning in Judiciary.
All right. I don't see anyone else. Representative Johnson, to your amendment.
Chair Mariani, Representative Hansen, I wish that you would take this amendment. It's dealing strictly with law enforcement and law enforcement officers that are employed by the state of Minnesota, not just the rank and file, but also their supervisors. We need the best quality supervisors along with the best trained officers. We have some of the best in the country. We have some of the highest standards for our officers, but it only works as good as the leadership above them. We saw how well that worked in Minneapolis. It hasn't worked well there because of there's some issues with their leadership starting at the mayor's office and the city council. Without top quality supervisors and leadership, I hate to think what's going to happen. With that, I do hope that you support this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson and members, I think the discussion Representative Johnson has put on the table is an appropriate discussion. Unfortunately, I think it's a discussion that should be had in another bill. The issue that Representative Hansen is trying to address in supporting our law enforcement agents has to do with the disparity that was created within that particular bargaining unit last year. And quite frankly, should be a bit of a lesson to all of us in terms of, you know, the extent to which, in my opinion, the extent to which legislators should not step into those collective bargaining discussions. Obviously, you know, we make the appropriation issues, we ask the questions, but boy, when we start stepping in, you know, in a very fine way, we run the risk of creating the problem that we now ought to really fix, you know, which is a disparity within that law enforcement unit. The issue Representative Johnson has raised, I think, is an appropriate issue, but it's a whole different unit. And by taking this step, I am convinced that we would repeat the disparity problem, and we'd probably have to step right back here shortly to fix that as well. That could be a pretty endless cycle for us as legislators. Perhaps we'll see another bill, and we'll have this conversation, but at this point, certainly would encourage members not to support the Johnson amendment. We're ready for a vote. I do see Representative Cleavon with her hand up.
Chair Mariani, you just took the words right out of my mouth. So thank you very much. I want to make sure that we're clear that we're supporting our law enforcement officers, but not getting involved in their collective bargaining process. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cleaver. With that, the motion, Representative Johnson renews his motion to adopt the House File 401 with the A2 amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
No.
Chair Mariani, nay. Vice Chair Frazier?
No.
Can you repeat that? Sorry.
No.
Vice Chair Frazier, nay. Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Edelson?
Nay.
Representative Edelson, nay. Representative Feist?
Nay.
Representative Feist, nay. Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hollins?
Nay.
Representative Hollins, nay. Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Hewitt, nay. Representative Cleaver?
No.
Representative Cleaver, nay. Representative Long?
No.
Representative Long, nay. Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Lucero, aye. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Representative Novotny, aye. Representative O'Neill?
Aye.
Representative O'Neill, aye. Representative Pinto?
Nay.
Representative Pinto, nay. Representative Poston?
Aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Vang?
No.
Representative Vang, nay. Representative Zhang, excused. That concludes roll call with 7 ayes and 10 nays.
Very well. With 7 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail, and House File 401 is not amended with the A2 amendment. Representative Hansen, we do have Assistant Commissioner Hodges here, I think, who wants to speak on the overall bill. And so let me call the Assistant Commissioner forward for his comments. We have about 4 or 5 minutes left, and then we'll move to a vote. Assistant Commissioner Hodges.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner Booker Hodges, B-O-K-E-R-H-O-D-G-E-S, for the person taking record. Thank you again for working to address the pay inequity issue. This bill addresses the concerns of the BCA and Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Agents, and we appreciate the legislature's commitment to making this situation right. The BCA and Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Agents have responded and will continue to respond with the utmost professionalism whenever we're called to protect public safety and ensure everyone has an opportunity to express their First Amendment rights. When law enforcement agencies work together, we're working together now more than ever. That's what a lot of people know. But it's important that all state law enforcement agencies, all state law enforcement personnel of comparable rank and tenure are compensated equally. The Department of Public Safety's efforts to hire a diverse workforce that reflects the people of Minnesota will be hampered if pay inequity isn't addressed. Law enforcement already faces hiring headwinds, as we've heard here earlier today, and it will be difficult for us to recruit new people and retain those we have when they can go to a different state agency and make significant more money. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will conclude my comments.
Very well. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. We have a couple hands up, so I think we have time for a couple quick questions. Representative Bowley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is along the lines of in the amendment that was offered, the testimony was we don't want to get into collective bargaining. We don't want to usurp that process. Is it normal that the legislature passes a bill for salary increases, and doesn't that in and of itself and by definition enter into the area of collective bargaining, Mr. Chair?
Representative Chair Hansen.
That's why we're in the problem we're in. That's why the bill is here, because we're fixing a problem. The legislature usually is not. in getting involved in it. And because it did in October, now we have to have this bill, House File 401, to correct that inequity. And we're correcting it within the bargaining unit and did not support extending it beyond this particular bargaining unit. There are several bargaining units in state government. This is the MLEA one. And as the chair mentioned, this is a caution for the legislature in getting involved in setting pay.
Representative Waller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Hansen, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I wish you would have taken my amendment because it's going to help clear up a lot of issues that we're going to be dealing with very quickly. Back in October when this original bill came up with that 8.4% increase for the state troopers, I spoke about this very issue, and unfortunately nobody took the warning that were given on the House floor that day. Now we're dealing with it. Thank you for taking care of it. The state troopers and every one of our state law enforcement officers, whether in gambling enforcement, fugitive division, gambling, they are all have been fantastic to work with. And I do support this bill. I'm going to ask my members to support it as well. But like I say, it's unfortunate we didn't clear up the other issue that we're going to have some big problems with, I feel, in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. You know, I've been here a long time, and it's not unusual over my years for us to come back and think, oh, why did we do that? You know, now we got to fix it. And at least there's a fix here. And, you know, my only regret is that we've got our law enforcement folks, some of those communities who, you know, are facing, you know, at best a confusing situation. So hopefully this bill will do right by them and then also inform us on how we should proceed in the future. Chair Hansen, quickly closing your bill and then we'll vote.
And ask for your support. And if anybody else would like to co-author, I would invite you to do so. Thank you.
Very well. With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 401, we did not amend this, right? Yep. That 401 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Lucero, aye. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Representative Novotny, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, aye.
Representative O'Neill, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
Aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang, excused. That concludes roll call with 17 ayes and 0 nays.
Very well. Out of all the 17 ayes and 0 nays, House File 401 is, the motion prevails, and House File 401 is referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you, Chair Hansen. Good luck with your bill as it moves forward. Members, that concludes our business for today. We will meet again at our regular time on Thursday. And so until then, this committee stands adjourned.